Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a massive collection of sources and distill them into the must-know facts, the unexpected history, and, well, the absolute best stories.
And today, we're tackling a real giant of 19th century French art, Ferdinand Victor Eugène Delacroix. Acknowledged leader, though often, you know, fiercely debated, of the French Romantic school. Just a huge force.
Yeah, the amount of material is almost overwhelming. We're talking, what, over 9,000 works linked to him by the end?
Exactly. So our mission today is pretty clear. Cut through all that.
Yeah.
Find the essential context, the really dramatic works, those surprising influences that defined him.
And position him really as this crucial link,
yeah.
You know, bridging the old masters and what became modern art.
To really get Delacroix, though, you first have to understand the artistic battleground he stepped onto. His whole identity was almost forged in opposition to his great rival, Ingres.
Ingres. Yeah, that was the clash in Paris at the time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. If you were serious about painting then, you kind of had to pick a side. Team Ingres. Neoclassicism.
Right. Championing clarity, line, careful form, looking back to Raphael. Line over color, essentially.
And Delacroix. He went the complete opposite direction. Looked further back, beyond the French school even, to the Venetians, Titian, Veronese, and especially Rubens.
So for him, it was color first.
Color, definitely.
Yeah.
And movement, explosive energy, intense drama. Ingres wanted structure, that static perfection.
Oh.
Delacroix wanted, well, passion, violence, nature, action.
But it wasn't just one out of motion, was it? There was calculation there. I love that quote from Baudelaire.
Oh, the Baudelaire quote is perfect. Passionately in love with passion, but coldly determined to express passion as clearly as possible.
Coldly determined. That's the key, isn't it?
It really is. It implies his rational mind controlling the explosion. He wasn't just, you know, throwing paint around. He was engineering an emotional response using really sophisticated techniques. Color theory, composition.
That intellectual control, it stops it from just being melodrama.
Precise.
Okay, so let's dig into the man himself. His origins are, well, they're pretty interesting, even a bit mysterious. Born 1798 near Paris.
Came from a good background initially. Educated, but tragedy hit early. His legal father, Charles Francois Delacroix, died in 1805.
And then his mother in 1814, so he was orphaned at 16.
Yeah, quite young. But the real intrigue, the shadow over his birth, is who his biological father might have been.
This is the Talleyrand connection, right?
Exactly. The sources strongly suggest that his legal father, Charles Francois, couldn't have actually conceived him at the time. Medical reasons.
So the finger points squarely at Charles Maurice de Talleyrand-Perigord, diplomat extraordinaire, family friend.
And the man who actually took over from Charles Francois as Minister of Foreign Affairs. It's quite the connection. Delacroix himself probably suspected it.
And there's more than just suspicion, right? People noted the resemblance later on.
Oh, yeah. Apparently the physical similarity between the adult Eugene and Talleyrand was striking. But it goes beyond looks.
The practical support.
That's crucial. Talleyrand provided support throughout Delacroix's career, often through what are described as these numerous anonymous commissions.
Which, for a young artist trying to break the mold, must have been vital, especially going up against the neoclassical establishment.
Absolutely essential. Think about it. You're young, maybe struggling financially, and you're deliberately provoking the powerful academy. You need a patron.
Someone with influence.
And Talleyrand, a master political operator, could offer both money and, just as importantly, protection. It kind of reframes his early ability to withstand criticism.
Makes sense. Despite all this potential drama behind the scenes, his formal training was very conventional, wasn't it?
Oh, completely. Studied classics, Lycée Louis le Grand. Then, from 1815, trained with Pierre Narcisse Caron.
Who was a disciple of Jacques-Louis David.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Pure neoclassical style.
Right. And his early pieces, like The Virgin of the Harvest from 1819, show he could do it perfectly well. That refined Raphael-esque drawing. The skill was there.
But the passion wasn't quite unleashed yet.
Not yet. That needed a catalyst. And the catalyst was his friend, Theodore Verrico.
And specifically, Géricault's painting, The Raft of the Medusa.
Oh, The Raft. That painting just exploded onto the scene. High drama, contemporary disaster, raw human suffering on a massive scale. It was romanticism announcing itself with force.
And Delacroix saw it and thought, okay, that's the way forward.
Seems like it. His immediate big response was The Bark of Dante in 1822. Dante and Virgil crossing the Styx, the damned souls clinging to the boat.
It debuted at the Paris Salon. Caused a huge stir.
Huge, yeah. And mostly negative from the establishment critics. They were shocked.
My, what? The energy, the color.
All of it. The frenzied movement, what they saw as an unfinished look, the vibrant, almost jarring colors, it was a direct challenge to neoclassical restraint.
But interestingly, the state still bought it for the Luxembourg galleries.
Right. And that set the pattern for his whole career, didn't it? Widespread official opposition, but then support from powerful, often more forward-thinking patrons or state figures.
He learned early on how to navigate that system, how to find support outside the Academy's approval.
He definitely did. He knew he was picking a fight.
So this controversial but successful debut launched him right into engaging with current events, which takes us nicely into our next section, political passion and the grand scale of suffering.
Yeah, he moved quickly from literary or religious themes to real-time political crises, specifically the Greek War of Independence against the Ottomans.
A cause celeb across Europe at the time, right? Fueled partly by Lord Byron.
Hugely. Byron was this embodiment of romantic ideals, the passionate artist involved in revolutionary action. Delacroix admired him enormously.
And Delacroix wades in with the massacre at Chios in 1824, which wasn't your typical heroic battle scene.
Not at all. That's what made it so radical. It showed Greek civilians being rounded up for death or slavery by the Turks. No heroism, no comfort. Just disaster.
That must have really provoked the establishment. History painting was supposed to be uplifting, moral.
Exactly. Think of David's oath of the Horatian noble sacrifice, clear moral choice. Chios offered none of that, just apathy, despair, suffering.
I remember that quote from Antoine Jean Gros, another artist he called it.
A massacre of art.
Yeah.
They hated it. If you're going to paint on that scale, show us virtue, show us heroism, or at least give us a clean line. Delacroix gave them raw suffering and this landscape that looked almost messy.
That messy quality, though, that's technically important, isn't it? Something changed in his technique around then.
Oh, massively. While he was working on Chios, he saw paintings by English landscape artists, John Constable, Richard Parkes Bonington.
And they were focused on light and color in a different way.
Completely different. Studying nature directly, trying to capture the effects of light. So Delacroix, inspired by this, apparently went back to Chios and made huge changes.
To the sky and background.
Yeah, painting them much more freely. And crucially, he started experimenting with putting dabs of pure, complementary color side by side.
Optical mixing, letting the viewer's eye blend the colors from a distance.
Precisely. Instead of mixing green on the palette, put down yellow next to blue. Small, broken brush strokes. It's a technique that directly points towards Impressionism. Decades later.
Wow. So a revolutionary technique to depict a politically charged tragedy that the Academy probably didn't even think was a suitable subject for high art.
That sums it up pretty well. A total rupture.
And he followed this up 2 years later, still on the Greek theme, with Greece on the ruins of Missolonghi, 1826.
Right. This was a direct response to another horrific event, the siege of Missolonghi in 1825, where the Greek defenders, rather than surrender to the Turks, basically chose mass suicide. Blew themselves up.
So the painting is more allegorical, a monument.
Yes, very much a monument. You have this central figure, a woman in Greek dress, breast bared, standing amidst the rubble. She's liberty or Greece personified.
Arms raised, imploringly.
Yes, a really dramatic gesture. It's clearly symbolizing freedom against tyranny, using that female figure as the sort of soul of the nation.
And the timing again, Byron had died at Missolonghi just the year before.
Exactly. Sealing that tragic romantic connection between the cause, the place, and the poet Delacroix admired so much.
So these early works really cemented his reputation. Not just a painter, but someone reacting powerfully, maybe even violently, to the world around him. Using color, scale, movement to express these huge emotions.
And that search for intense feeling, for drama, leads us right into his next phase. Violence, sensuality, and the literary imagination.
That trip to England in 1825 seems important here, too. Seeing Constable and Bonington wasn't just about landscape, was it?
No, it reinforced his whole approach to color. He visited portraitists like Thomas Lawrence, too. It solidified his move away from strict linearity.
You can really see that in the portrait of Louis Gost Schwider, can't you? Painted around 1826-30, it's quite elegant, but the color handling is so rich, one of his few full-length portraits.
It is beautiful. But beyond portraits, he really dives into literature for inspiration, especially authors dealing with passion, darkness, history.
And he wasn't just painting based on them. He was a lithographer, too.
Hmm? A very fine one, yes. Hugely prolific. Illustrating Shakespeare thinks the death of Ophelia, Hamlet scenes Goethe's Faust, Walter Scott's historical novels. He's visually interpreting the great romantic narratives.
But the painting that really combines literature, violence, and sensuality in the most extreme way has to be The Death of Sardanapalus from 1827-28.
Oh, Sardanapalus, yeah. That is peak dark romanticism right there. A massive, overwhelming canvas.
Based on a play by Byron again, right? But Delacroix really amps it up.
He takes the story of the doomed Assyrian king, Sardanapalus, who, facing defeat, orders everything he values destroyed before the enemy arrives. Servants, concubines, horses, treasures, and he turns it into this opulent nightmare.
The king sits on his own funeral pyre, watching it all unfold.
Watching with this terrifying, calm detachment as chaos erupts around him. Silk, gold, jewels, blood, slaughter.
The shock value must have been immense. It's so visually rich, exotic colors, sensual figures, but then just horror.
Absolute horror. Look at the foreground, that struggling nude woman about to have her throat cut, jewels scattered around, dying animals. The whole composition is this whirlwind of diagonals.
The dying horse, the victims, all angled dramatically.
Exactly. Fighting against the static central figure of the impassive king. It's visual anarchy, barely contained.
But wasn't he criticized for just exploiting the violence and nudity, using a literary source as an excuse for pure sensation?
Oh, absolutely. Critics were appalled. They saw the gore, the chaos, the eroticism.
Yeah.
But for Delacroix and for Romanticism, this was about the sublime, that mix of terror and beauty, pushing passion to its absolute limit.
And the king's detachment, is that part of the romantic ideal?
It's often interpreted that way, yeah. Transcending the physical horror through willpower or indifference.
Yeah.
But yeah, the official reaction was overwhelmingly negative. The painting was so disturbing, it wasn't shown again for ages.
So a huge swing from the political suffering of Chios to this theatrical, self-inflicted, almost eroticized violence. Same energy, different subject.
He kept exploring that dark historical vein. In 1829, the murder of the Bishop of Liège, inspired by Walter Scott. Another medieval scene. Very dramatic.
And technically impressive too, right? The use of light and shadow.
The chiaroscuro, yeah, it's fantastic. We know he based the setting, that huge vaulted hall, on sketches he'd made of places like the Palais de Justice in Rouen and maybe even Westminster Hall.
So bringing architectural realism into these historical fantasies.
Right. And the brushwork itself had that characteristic energy. There's a great quote from a critic in 1855 describing it.
What did they say?
Something like, "Less finished than a painting, more finished than a sketch, left by the painter at that supreme moment when one more stroke of the brush would have ruined everything."
Capturing that perfect moment of spontaneity, that really sums up his appeal, doesn't it?
It does, and that energy absolutely explodes in his most famous work.
Which brings us to the next big moment: liberty, legacy, and political explosiveness. We have to talk about Liberty Leading the People, 1830.
The definitive image of the Romantic movement, maybe. You can definitely argue that. Painted right after the July Revolution of 1830, the three glorious days that kicked out King Charles X.
It's such a powerful image, part real, part allegory.
Completely dominated by Liberty herself, right? The symbolic, powerful figure marching over the barricade, holding the tricolor flag. She embodies the will of the people.
And the people around her are so specific, not just generic figures.
No, you've got the street kid with the pistols, Gavroche-like figure, the factory worker, the bourgeois guy in the top hat. All classes united in that moment of uprising.
But then grounded by the reality of the foreground.
Yes, that's the crucial counterpoint. The dead soldiers, the cost of the revolution, lying right there at Liberty's feet. It's triumph mixed with sacrifice.
So the new government, Louis-Philippe's regime, they bought the painting.
They did. But then they almost immediately got cold feet.
Too inflammatory, even though it celebrated the revolution that brought them to power.
Exactly. They realized pretty quickly that glorifying street revolution could be, well, dangerous for any government, even the one that just benefited from it. By 1832, it was taken down, deemed too inflammatory for public view.
Wow. That says a lot about its power. The government was literally scared of the art it owned.
It really does. It stayed hidden away for years.
Until when?
Wasn't put back on proper display until after the next revolution, the one in 1848, under Louis Napoleon, later Napoleon III. Then its status as the symbol of French republicanism was locked in.
And that connection to Les Misérables, the boy inspiring Gavroche?
Widely believed, yeah. Though maybe more speculation than proven fact. But it shows how the painting entered the cultural imagination.
So Liberty ties together revolution, myth, literature, and his signature style. Color, movement, passion. Where do you even go after creating something like that?
Well, Delacroix went somewhere completely different, personally and artistically. Which leads us to phase 5, the exotic escape and North African travel.
The trip in 1832 with the diplomatic mission.
That's the one. With Charles Edgar de Mornay, they traveled through Spain, then into North Africa, Morocco mainly. This was just after France had conquered Algeria, so it was a politically charged region too.
And his reason for going wasn't just artistic tourism. He wanted to get away.
He explicitly said so. He wanted to escape the constraints of Paris, find something more primitive, more authentic, as he saw it, away from European conventions.
And this trip becomes foundational for the whole Orientalist movement in art, right? Though maybe his version was a bit different.
It was, yes. It fed into Orientalism, this fascination with the East. But Delacroix wasn't just looking for exoticism for its own sake. He was looking for a connection to the classical past.
How so?
He was absolutely captivated by the people he saw, their clothes, their bearing. He felt they had a dignity, a way of moving and dressing that was closer to ancient Romans and Greeks than anything he saw in modern Paris.
Didn't he write something about that in his journal?
He did. Something like, "The Greeks and Romans are here at my door, in the Arabs who wrap themselves in a white blanket and look like Cato or Brutus."
So he saw North Africa not just as other, but as a living link to the classical world he admired.
Exactly. He was synthesizing, seeing classical dignity through the lens of vibrant, real-world color and light, not through the cold white marble of neoclassicism. It was almost a critique of his own society.
Combining classical ideals with romantic execution.
That's a good way to put it. And the trip unleashed a torrent of work. Over 100 paintings and drawings came out of it.
But he ran into difficulties, didn't he? Especially trying to paint women.
Big time. Religious and cultural norms meant Muslim women were largely inaccessible to a male European artist. They had to remain covered and secluded.
But he managed somehow for that famous painting, Women of Algiers.
Yes, he got special, discreet permission to sketch some women in a private home in Algiers. That resulted in Women of Algiers in their apartment, 1834. It's incredible, so intimate, glowing with color, a real contrast to the violence of some earlier works.
A moment of quiet observation.
Definitely. He had less trouble painting subjects from the Jewish communities, though. That led to works like The Jewish Wedding in Morocco from 1839.
And the trip also seemed to boost his interest in painting animals, horses, lions.
Oh, absolutely. For romantics, powerful animals often embodied pure, untamed passion. Nature's energy, free from civilization's constraints.
So horses fighting, lions hunting, these became major themes.
Yeah, think of Arab horses fighting in a stable, 1860, or the various versions of the lion hunt. They're all about that raw, dynamic energy. The animal is a symbol of primal force.
It feels like as he got older, his focus shifted slightly. Less reaction to immediate events, more towards these sustained, large-scale projects. Which brings us to religious works, musical inspirations, and those huge monumental commissions.
It's true. Despite the sometimes scandalous or violent nature of his famous works, he had a lifelong engagement with Christian themes. Hundreds of religious paintings.
Which seems a bit paradoxical given that some sources suggest he wasn't conventionally religious, maybe agnostic.
It is fascinating. But for Delacroix, the stories of Christianity, the suffering, the redemption, the miracles, offered perfect vehicles for exploring profound human emotion on a grand scale.
So works like Christ on the Sea of Galilee, he did multiple versions.
Yes, exploring that theme of faith tested by natural chaos.
Mm.
And his interpretations had power. His Pietà Mary Mourning Christ was later copied by Van Gogh. That shows the emotional resonance.
And alongside painting, music remained incredibly important to him, didn't it?
Absolutely essential. He wrote about needing it constantly, said something like, "Nothing can be compared with the emotion caused by music," that it put him in a state of exaltation needed for creation.
Did he connect specific composers to his work?
Beethoven seems to have been a major inspiration, that sense of scale, drama, emotional intensity. And he was close friends with Chopin.
Ah, the double portrait with George Sand that got cut up.
Sadly, yes. We only have the fragments now. But you can imagine him responding to the rhythm, the harmonies, the emotional arcs in music, and trying to translate that feeling into color and composition.
And this energy, fueled by music perhaps, helped him tackle these enormous public commissions later in his career.
Definitely. Starting around 1833, he began receiving major government contracts to decorate public buildings. This was a chance to work on the kind of architectural scale he admired in the old masters.
Like Veronese, Tintoretto, Rubens, the great decorators.
Exactly. It was a lifelong ambition. But it required a different kind of discipline than studio painting. Years of sustained effort.
We're talking huge projects. The Salon du Roi at the Palais Bourbon, libraries in the Palais Bourbon and the Luxembourg, the ceiling of the Galerie de Poulain in the Louvre.
Monumental undertakings. And incredibly demanding physically. Imagine spending years up on scaffolding, dealing with fresco techniques or painting on dry plaster, trying to make your colors work across vast, often curved surfaces.
It's a world away from the perceived spontaneity of some of his other work.
It really is. It shows incredible range and discipline.
And the culmination of all this was his final major commission, the chapel at Saint-Sulpice.
The Chapelle des Anges at Saint-Sulpice, yes. Completed between 1857 and 1861. It's considered his masterpiece in mural painting.
Featuring
two massive, incredibly dynamic scenes. Jacob wrestling with the angel and the expulsion of Heliodorus from the temple. They have this amazing energy, dramatic lighting. Art historians often call it the finest mural painting of his time.
It must have taken a tremendous toll on him physically.
It did. His health was already fragile, and the years of labor on these murals really wore him down.
And this is where his housekeeper becomes important. Jenny?
Jean-Marie Leguillou, yes.
Yeah.
Jenny. She was incredibly devoted, fiercely protective of his privacy in his later years, managed everything for him. Many credit her care with allowing him to keep working as long as he did.
A touching detail. The great public artist needing that private support.
It humanizes him, doesn't it?
It does. Which brings us to his final legacy and those unusual final instructions. First, just the sheer volume of work he left. That 1864 sale. Over 9,000 items.
Just staggering. About 850 paintings, over 1,500 pastels and watercolors, and get this, over 6,600 drawings.
Wow. All that drawing really underlines his own quote, doesn't it?
Color always occupies me, but drawing preoccupies me. Yes. For all his fame as a colorist, the foundation was constant, obsessive drawing.
And his impact on the artists who followed. Immense.
Foundational for modernism, really. His expressive brushwork, his ideas about color, especially how shadows aren't just black but contain color that directly influenced the Impressionists.
Manet, Renoir, they copied his works.
Obsessively, trying to figure out how he did it. And someone like Degas bought the portrait of Baron Schweider for his own collection. They knew he was the key figure.
The direct line runs through him.
Absolutely. From the old masters through Romanticism, pointing directly to Impressionism and beyond.
And we also have his journal, which gives us insight into his thinking.
A fantastic resource. His thoughts on art, life, politics. Very eloquent, very revealing.
Which makes his final instruction even more striking. He died August 13, 1863. But his will contained something quite specific.
Extremely specific and unusual. He put in a clause expressly forbidding any representation of his features after his death.
No death mask, no drawings, no photographs.
Nothing. I forbid it expressly, he wrote.
That's quite something. For an artist who spent his life creating unforgettable images of human drama, liberty, the Greeks, Sardanapalus, to then demand his own image be erased.
It's a profound final act, almost a contradiction. The master image maker wanting his own physical form to vanish from the record.
So wrapping this up, Delacroix, the romantic who fused politics, literature, exoticism, classicism, all through color and movement, paving the way for modern art.
Yet ending with this command for anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes you think about the man versus the work, doesn't it?
Why would he do that? After being, as Baudelaire said, passionately in love with passion, but coldly determined to express it, why erase the expressor?
Perhaps he wanted the art, the energy, the color, the emotion he engineered to be his sole legacy. Not the frail human appearance. The work transcends the man.
And the work certainly endures. Its themes feel incredibly current sometimes. If you want proof, you should look up how a contemporary artist like Yu Min-jun reinterpreted the massacre at Chios. That sense of suffering, political commentary, it still resonates.
It really does. And it's a final, powerful irony, isn't it? The ultimate master of visual drama ending with an act of deliberate visual erasure. A perfectly calculated final provocation.